There was little I could do for the prisoner, try as I might. Claude would eventually find the music he could not stand, and if I did not help him, my reputation as a good student would lose a little of its luster. The prisoner's only real hope of escaping from his situation lay not with me, but with the liberation of the entire South. So I said, "Country music. The average Vietnamese cannot bear it. That southern twang, that peculiar rhythm, those strange stories, the music drives us a little crazy." "Perfect," Claude said. "So what song's it going to be?" After a little research, I procured a record from the jukebox of one of the Saigon bars populated by white soldiers. He, good-looking, was by the famous Hank Williams, the country music icon whose nasal voice personified the utter whiteness of the music, at least to our ears. Even someone as exposed to American culture as I shivered a little on hearing this record, somewhat scratchy from having been played so many times. Country music was the most segregated kind of music in America, where even whites played jazz and even blacks sang in the opera. Something like country music was what lynch mobs must have enjoyed while stringing up their black victims. Country music was not necessarily lynching music, but no other music could be imagined as lynching's accompaniment. Beethoven's Ninth was the opus for Nazis, concentration camp commanders, and possibly President Truman, as he contemplated atomizing Hiroshima. Classical music, the refined score for the high-minded extermination of brutish hordes. Country music was set to the more humble beat of the red-blooded, bloodthirsty American heartland. It was for fear of being beaten to this beat that black soldiers avoided the Saigon bars where white comrades kept the jukeboxes humming with Hank Williams and his kind. Sonic signposts that said, in essence, "No niggers." It was with confidence, then, that I chose this song to be played on an endless loop in the prisoner's room, except for the times when I was in it. Claude had assigned me to be the chief interrogator, the task of breaking the prisoner my graduation exam from his interrogation course. We kept the prisoner in the room for a week before I saw him, nothing interrupting the constant light and music except the opening of a slot in his door three times a day when his meal was shoved through. A bowl of rice, 100 grams of boiled greens, 50 grams of boiled meat, 12 ounces of water. If he behaved well, we told him, we would give him the food of his choice. I watched him on the video feed as he ate his food, as he squatted over his hole, as he washed himself from his bucket, as he paced his room, as he lay on his bed with his forearm over his eyes, as he did push-ups and sit-ups, and as he plugged his ears with his fingers. When he did so, I turned up the volume, forced to do something with Claude standing by my side. When he took his fingers out of his ears and I lowered the volume, he looked up at one of the cameras and shouted in English, "Fuck you, Americans." Claude chuckled. "At least he's talking. It's the ones who don't say anything you really have to worry about." He was the leader of cell C7 of terrorist unit Z99, based in the secret zone of Binh Duong province. Z99 was collectively responsible for hundreds of grenade attacks, minings, bombings and mortarings, and assassinations that had killed a few thousand and terrorized Saigon. Z99's trademark was the dual bomb attack, the second designed to kill the rescuers who came to help the victims of the first. Our prisoner's speciality was the adaptation of wristwatches as triggering devices for these improvised bombs. The second and our hands were removed from a watch. A battery wire was inserted through a hole in the crystal, and the minute hand was set to the desired delay time. When the ticking minute hand touched the wire, the bomb detonated. Bombs were built from landmines, stolen from U.S. supplies, or bought on the black market. Other bombs were assembled from TNT that was smuggled into the city in small quantities, hidden in hollowed-out pineapples and baguettes and the like, even in women's bras, which led to endless jokes about the special branch. We knew Z99 had a watchmaker, and before we had known exactly who he was, we called him the Watchman, which was how I thought of him. The Watchman regarded me with amusement the first time I entered his room, a week after we began his treatment. It was not the reaction I expected. "Hey, good-looking," he said in English. I sat on his chair and he on his bed, a tiny, shivering man with a full head of coarse hair, shockingly black in the white room. "I appreciate the English lesson," he said, grinning at me. "Keep playing that music. I love it." Of course he didn't. There was a glint in his eye, the briefest hint of unwellness. Although that might have come from being a graduate of philosophy from the University of Saigon, and the eldest son of a respectable Catholic family who had disowned him for his revolutionary activities. Watchmaking of the legitimate kind, for that was indeed his profession before he became a terrorist, was simply to pay the bills, as he told me during our initial conversation. This was small talk, get-to-know-you kind of stuff. But lurking underneath the flirtation was our mutual awareness of our roles as prisoner and interrogator. My awareness was compounded by knowing that Claude was watching us on the video monitor. I was thankful for the air conditioning, otherwise I would have been sweating, trying to figure out how to be both enemy and friend to the watchman. I laid out the charges against him of subversion, conspiracy, and murder, but emphasized that he was innocent until proven guilty, which made him laugh. "Your American puppet masters like to say that, but it's stupid," he said. "History, humanity, religion, this war tells us exactly the reverse. We are all guilty until proven innocent. As even the Americans have shown, why else do they believe everyone is really Viet Cong? Why else do they shoot first and ask questions later? Because to them, all yellow people are guilty until proven innocent. Americans are a confused people because they can't admit this contradiction. They believe in a universe of divine justice where the human race is guilty of sin, but they also believe in a secular justice where human beings are presumed innocent. You can't have both. You know how Americans deal with it? They pretend they are eternally innocent no matter how many times they lose their innocence. The problem is that those who insist on their innocence believe anything they do is just. At least we who believe in our own guilt know what dark things we can do." I was impressed with his understanding of American culture and psychology, but I could not show it. Instead, I said, "So you would rather be presumed guilty?" "If you haven't understood that your masters already believe me to be guilty and will treat me as such, then you're not as smart as you think you are. But that is hardly a surprise. You're a bastard, and like all hybrids, you are defective." In retrospect, I do not believe he meant to insult me. Like most philosophers, he simply lacked social skills. In his graceless way, he was merely stating what he and many others thought to be scientific fact. And yet, in that white room, I admit that I saw red. I could have dragged out this interrogation for years if I wanted to, asking him relentless questions that led nowhere as I tried, seemingly, to find his weakness, secretly keeping him safe. But instead, all I wanted at that moment was to prove to him that I was, indeed, as smart as I thought I was, which meant smarter than him. Between the two of us, only one could be the master. The other had to be the slave. How did I prove this to him? One night in my quarters, after my rage had cooled and hardened, it struck me that I, the bastard, understood him, the philosopher, with perfect clarity. A person's strength was always his weakness, and vice versa. The weakness was there to be seen if one could see it. In the watchman's case, he was the revolutionary willing to walk away from the most important thing to a Vietnamese and a Catholic, his family, for whom the only acceptable sacrifice was God. His strength was in his sacrifice, and that had to be destroyed. I sat down immediately at my desk and wrote the watchman's confession for him. He read my scenario the next morning in disbelief, then read it again before glaring at me. "You're saying that I'm saying I'm a faggot?" "Homosexual," I corrected. "You're going to spread filth about me?" he said. "Lies? I have never been a faggot. I have never dreamed of being a faggot. This is dirty." His voice rose and his face flushed. "To have me say I joined a revolution because I loved a man? To say this was why I ran away from my family? That my faggotry explains my love for philosophy? That being a faggot is the reason for my wish to destroy society? That I betrayed the revolution so I could save the man I loved, whom you have captured? No one will believe this." "Then no one will care when we publish it in the newspapers, along with your lover's confession and intimate photographs of the two of you." "You will never get me in such a photograph." The CIA has remarkable talents with hypnosis and drugs. He fell silent. I continued. When the newspapers cover this, you realize it's not only your revolutionary comrades who will condemn you. The road back to your family will be closed forever, too. They might accept a reform revolutionary, or even a victorious one, but they will never accept a homosexual, no matter what happens to our country. You'll be a man who sacrificed everything for nothing. You will not even be a memory to your comrades or your family. At least if you talk to me, this confession won't be published. Your reputation will stay intact until the day the war is over. I stood up. Think about it. He said nothing and did nothing except stare at his confession. I paused at the door. Still think I'm a bastard? No, he said tonelessly. You're just an asshole. Why had I done that? In my white room, I had nothing but time on my hands to ponder this event I had whitewashed from my mind. The event to which I am confessing now. The watchman had infuriated me, pushing me into irrational action with his pseudo-scientific judgment. But he would not have been able to do so if I had simply executed my role as the mole. Instead, I confess I took pleasure in doing what I was supposed to do and not supposed to do, interrogate him until he broke, as Claude had requested. He replayed the scene for me later in the surveillance room, where I watched myself watching the watchman as he stared at his confession, knowing he was out of time, a character in a movie, as it were, that Claude had produced and I directed. The watchman could not represent himself. I had represented him. Brilliant work, Claude said. You really fucked this guy. I was a good student. I knew what my teacher wanted, and more than that, I enjoyed his praise at the expense of the bad student. For wasn't that what the watchman was? He had learned what the Americans taught, but he had rejected those teachings outright. I was more sympathetic to the thinking of Americans, and I confess that I could not help but see myself in their place as I broke the watchman. He threatened them, and thus, to some extent, me. But the satisfaction I had at his expense did not last long. In the end, he would show everyone what it was that a bad student could accomplish. He would outsmart me by proving that it was possible to sabotage the means of production that you did not own, to destroy the representation that owned you. His final move happened one morning a week after I had shown him his confession, when I got a call at the officer's quarters from the guard in the surveillance room. By the time I reached the National Interrogation Center, Claude was also there. The watchman was curled up on his white bed, facing the white wall, clad in his white shorts and t-shirt. When we rolled him over, his face was purple and his eyes bulged. Deep in his open mouth, at the back of his throat, a white lump. "I just went to the bathroom," the guard blubbered. "He was eating breakfast. What was he going to do in 2 minutes?" What the watchman had done was choke himself to death. He had been on good behavior for the past week, and we had rewarded him with what he wanted for breakfast. "I like hard-boiled eggs," he said. So he had peeled and eaten the first two before swallowing the third one whole, shell and all. "Hey, good-looking." "Turn off that goddamn music," Claude said to the guard. Time had stopped for the watchman. What I did not realize until I woke up in my own white room was that time had stopped for me, too. I could see that other white room with utter clarity from my own, my eye peering through a camera in the corner, watching Claude and myself standing over the watchman. "It's not your fault," said Claude. Even I didn't think about this. He patted my shoulder reassuringly, but I said nothing. The smell of sulfur driving everything out of my mind, except for the thought that I was not a bastard. I was not a bastard. I was not. I was not. I was not. Unless, somehow, I was. Chapter 12. By the time I emerged from the hospital, my services were no longer needed, and I was not invited back to the set for the mopping-up operation that took place after the shooting was completed. Instead, I found that an airplane ticket had been reserved for my instant departure from the Philippines, and I spent the entire trip brooding over the problem of representation. Not to own the means of production can lead to premature death, but not to own the means of representation is also a kind of death. For if we are represented by others, might they not, one day, hose our death off memory's laminated floor? Still smarting from my wounds even now, I cannot help but wonder, writing this confession, whether I own my own representation, or whether you, my confessor, do. The sight of Bond waiting for me at the Los Angeles airport made me feel a little better. He looked exactly the same, and when I opened our apartment door, I was relieved to see that while it had not improved, neither had it worsened. The Frigidaire remained our decrepit diorama's main attraction, thoughtfully stocked by Bond with enough beer to cure me of my jet lag, though not enough to cure me of the unexpected sadness massaged into my pores. I was still awake when he went to sleep, leaving me with the latest letter from my Parisian aunt. Before I retired, I dutifully composed my report to her. The Hamlet was complete, I wrote, but more important, the movement had established a revenue source. A restaurant? I had said when Bond broke the news of our first round of beer. That's what I said. Madame's actually a good cook. Hers was the last decent Vietnamese food I had eaten, reason enough for me to call the general the next day and congratulate him on Madame's new enterprise. As expected, he urged me to come for a welcome back meal at the restaurant, which I found on Chinatown's Broadway, bracketed by a tea shop and an herbalist. Once we had surrounded the Chinese in Cholon, the general said from behind his cash register, now we're surrounded by them. He sighed, his hands resting on the keys of the register, ready to bash out a harsh tune on that makeshift piano. Remember when I came here with nothing? Of course I remember, I said, even though the general had not actually come here with nothing. Madame had sewn a considerable number of gold ounces into the lining of her clothes and her children's, and the general had strapped a money belt full of dollars around his waist. But amnesia was as American as apple pie, and it was much preferred by Americans over both humble pie and the fraught foods of foreign intruders. Like us, Americans were suspicious of unfamiliar food, which they identified with the strangers who brought them. We instinctively knew that in order for Americans to find refugees like us acceptable, they first had to find our food digestible, not to mention affordable and pronounceable. Because it was no easy thing to overcome this digestive skepticism, or make a profit from it. A dimension of courage existed in General and Madame's enterprise, as I told him. Courageous? I find it degrading. Did you ever foresee the day when I would own a restaurant? The General gestured at the small confines of what had previously been a chop suey house, brown measles of grease still speckling the walls. No, sir, I said. Well, neither did I. It could at least have been a nice restaurant instead of this. He spoke with such pathetic resignation, I felt a renewed sympathy for him. Nothing had been done to renovate the restaurant. The linoleum floor battered, the yellow paint dull, the overhead lighting flat and harsh. The waiters were, he pointed out, veterans. That one's special forces. That one's airborne. In trucker caps and ill-fitting dress shirts that must have been rummaged from a thrift store, or bestowed on them by a strapping sponsor, the waiters did not look like killers. They looked like the anonymous men with bad haircuts who delivered Chinese takeout, the men who waited nervously in hospital emergency rooms without insurance, who fled the scenes of car accidents because they did not have licenses or registration. They wobbled as much as the table that the general led me to, its base uneven. Madame herself brought me a bowl of the pho special and joined us, both watching me eat one of the best examples I'd ever indulged in of our national soup. It's still delicious, I said, after the first sip and bite. Madame remained unmoved, as glum as her husband. You should be proud of such soup. We should be proud of selling soup, Madame said. Or owning a hole in the wall? That's what one of our customers called this place. We don't even own it, said the general. We lease it. Their moroseness was matched by their appearance. Madame's hair was pinned back in a librarian's stale bun, when before it had almost always been worn in a glamorous bouffant or beehive that recalled the go-go days of the early 60s. She, like the general, wore off-the-rack clothing consisting of a mannish polo shirt, shapeless khakis, and the American footwear of choice, sneakers. They wore, in short, what almost every other middle-aged American couple I had encountered at the supermarket, the post office, or the gas station wore. The sartorial impression was to make them, like many American adults, look like overgrown children, the effect enhanced when these adults were spotted, as they often were, sucking on extra-large sodas. These petit bourgeois restaurateurs were not the aristocratic patriots I had lived with for 5 years, and for whom I felt not only some fear, but also a degree of affection. Their sadness was my sadness, too. So I turned the conversation toward a topic I knew might lift their spirits. "So," I said, "what's this about the restaurant funding the revolution?" "A wonderful idea, isn't it?" said the general, brightening. Seeing Madame's eyes turn to the ceiling, I suspected that it was, in fact, her idea. "Hole in the wall or not, this is the first such restaurant in this city," he said. "Perhaps even in this country. As you can see, our countrymen are starving for a taste of home. Although it was only 11:30 in the morning, every table and booth was occupied by people eating soup with chopsticks in one hand and spoon in the other. The restaurant was redolent with the fragrance of home and resonant with sounds, the chatter of our native tongue competing with heartfelt slurping. This is a non-profit enterprise, so to speak," said the general. "All profits go to the movement." And when I asked who knew about this, Madame said, "Everyone and no one. It's a secret, but an open secret. People come here, and their soup is spiced with the idea they're helping the revolution. As for the revolution," the general said, "everything is almost in place, even the uniforms. Madame is in charge of those, as well as the women's auxiliary, and the making of flags. What a spectacle she can create. You missed the Tet celebration she organized in Orange County. You should have seen it. I have photos to show you. How the people cried and cheered when they saw our men in camouflage and uniform carrying our flag. We've assembled the first companies of volunteers, all veterans. They train every weekend. From this group, we're going to call the best for the next step." He leaned over the table to whisper the rest. "We're sending a reconnaissance team to Thailand. They'll link up with our forward field base and reconnoiter a path overland to Vietnam. Claude says the time is nearly right." I poured myself a cup of tea. "Is Bon a part of this team?" "Of course. I hate to lose such a good worker, but he's the best we have for this kind of work. What do you think?" "I was thinking that the only route overland from Thailand involved trekking through Laos or Cambodia, avoiding established roads and choosing the treacherous terrain of disease-ridden jungles, forests, and mountains, where the only inhabitants would be brooding monkeys, man-eating tigers, and hostile, frightened locals unlikely to give aid. These badlands were the perfect setting for a movie, and a horrible one for a mission that was almost certainly do or die. I would not have to tell Bond this. My crazy friend had volunteered, not despite the fact that his chance of returning was slim, but because of them. I looked at my hand, and the red scar engraved there. I was suddenly aware of the outline of my body, of the sensation of the chair underneath my thighs, of the fragility of the force holding together my body and my life. It would not take much to destroy that force, which most of us took for granted until the moment when we could not. What I think," I said, not allowing myself to deliberate any further, "is that if Bond is going, I should go too." The general clapped his hands together in delight and turned to Madame. "What did I tell you? I knew he would volunteer. Captain, I never had any doubt. But you know as well as I that you'll do better staying here and working with me on the planning and logistics, not to mention the fundraising and the diplomacy. I've told the congressman the community is gathering funds to send an aid team to help the refugees in Thailand. That is, in a sense, what we're doing. But we'll need to continue persuading our supporters of that cause. Or at least give them a reason to pretend to believe that is our cause," I said. The general nodded with satisfaction. "Exactly right. I know you're disappointed, but it's for the best. You'll be more useful here than there, and Bond can take care of himself. Now look, it's nearly noon. I think it's the right time for a beer, don't you?" Visible over Madame's shoulder was a clock hanging on the wall between a flag and a poster. The poster was for a new brand of beer, featuring three bikini-clad young women spreading breasts the size and shape of children's balloons. The flag was of the defeated Republic of Vietnam. Three bold red horizontal stripes on a vivid field of yellow. This was the flag, as the general had noted more than once to me, of the Free Vietnamese People. I had seen the flag countless times before, and posters like that one often, but I had never seen this type of clock carved from hardwood into the shape of our homeland. For this clock that was a country, and this country that was a clock, the minute and hour hands pivoted in the south, the numbers of the dial a halo around Saigon. Some craftsman in exile had understood that this was exactly the timepiece his refugee countrymen desired. We were displaced persons, but it was time more than space that defined us. While the distance to return to our lost country was far but finite, the number of years it would take to close that distance was potentially infinite. Thus, for displaced people, the first question was always about time. When can I return? "Speaking of punctuality," I said to Madame, "your clock is set to the wrong time." "No," she said, rising to fetch the beer. "It's set to Saigon time." Of course it was. How could I have not seen it? Saigon time was 14 hours off. Although if one judged time by this clock, it was we who were 14 hours off. Refugee, exiled, immigrant, whatever species of displaced human we were, we did not simply live in two cultures, as celebrants of the great American melting pot imagined. Displaced people also lived in two time zones, the here and the there, the present and the past, being as we were, reluctant time travelers. But while science fiction imagined time travelers as moving forward or backward in time, this timepiece demonstrated a different chronology. The open secret of the clock, naked for all to see, was that we were only going in circles. After lunch, I debriefed the general and Madame on my Philippine adventures, which simultaneously lightened their gloominess and heightened their sense of resentment. Resentment was an antidote to gloominess, as it was for sadness, melancholy, despair, etc. One way to forget a certain kind of pain was to feel another kind of pain, as when the doctor examining you for mandatory military service, an exam that you never fail unless you are afflicted by wealth, slaps you on one butt cheek while injecting you in the other. The one thing I did not tell the general and Madame, besides myself nearly meeting the fate of one of those roasted ducks hung from its anus in the neighboring Chinese eatery's window, was that I had been paid compensation for my near butchering. The morning after the extras had come bearing gifts, I received two other visitors, Violet and a tall, thin white man in a powder blue suit, his paisley tie as fat as Elvis Presley, and his shirt the rich yellow color of urine after a meal of asparagus. "How do you feel?" she asked. "All white," I whispered, although I could speak perfectly fine. She looked at me suspiciously and said, "We're all concerned about you. He wanted you to know he would have come himself, but President Marcos is visiting the set today." He, who did not need to be named, was, of course, the auteur. I merely nodded sagely and sadly and said, "I understand," though the mere mention of him infuriated me. "This is the best hospital in Manila," the man in the white suit said, flashing a searchlight of a smile onto my face. "We all want the best possible care for you. How are you feeling?" "To tell you the truth," I said, proceeding to lie, "I feel terrible." "What a shame," he said. "Let me introduce myself." He produced a pristine white business card with edges so sharp I feared a paper cut. "I am a representative for the film studio. We want you to know we are paying all the bills for your hospital care." "What happened?" "You don't remember?" Violet asked. "An explosion, a lot of explosions." "It was an accident." "I have the report here," said the representative, lifting a liver-colored briefcase high enough for me to see its gleaming gold buckles. "Such efficiency." I skimmed the report. Its details were not as significant as what its existence proved. That fast work of this type, as in our homeland, was only possible by an application of grease to the palms. "Am I lucky to be alive?" "Extremely lucky," he said. "You have your life, your well-being, and a check in my briefcase for the sum of $5,000. According to the medical reports I've seen, you suffered smoke inhalation, some scrapes and bruises, a few mild burns, a bump on your head, and a concussion. Nothing broken, nothing ruptured, nothing permanent. but the studio wants to ensure that all your needs are met." The representative opened the briefcase and produced a stapled document of white papers and a long slip of green paper, the check. "Of course, you will have to sign a receipt, as well as this document releasing the studio from any future obligations." Was $5,000 the worth of my miserable life? Admittedly, it was a considerable amount, more than I had seen at any one time. That was what they were counting on, but even in my dazed state, I knew better than to settle for the first offer. "Thank you for this generous pledge," I said. "It is decent of the studio to worry on my behalf, to be so concerned with me. But as you may know, or maybe you do not know, I am my extended family's principal support. $5,000 is wonderful if I thought only of myself, but an Asian..." Here I paused and allowed a faraway look to come into my eyes, the better to give them time to imagine the vast genealogical banyan tree extending above me, overshadowing me with the oppressive weight of generations come to root on the top of my head. "An Asian cannot think just about himself." "So I've heard," said the representative. "The family is everything, like us Italians." "Yes, you Italians. The Asian must think of his mother, his father, his siblings, his grandparents, his cousins, his village. If word got out of my good luck, it would be endless. The favors, the requests for $50 here, $100 there, hands tugging at me from all directions. I could not decline. So you see the situation I find myself in. It would be better to take none of the money. I would spare myself these emotional hardships. Or the alternative, to have enough money to take care of all those favors, as well as myself." The representative waited for me to continue, but I waited for him to reply. At last he gave in and said, "Not being aware of the complications of Asian families, I am also not aware of the appropriate sum that might satisfy all your familial obligations, which I understand are important to your culture, and which I respect greatly." I waited for him to continue, but he waited for me to reply. "I cannot be certain," I said, "although, without certainty, I believe $20,000 would suffice to satisfy any needs of my relatives, anticipated and unanticipated." $20,000. The representative's eyebrows performed a graceful yoga pose, arching their backs in disturbingly steep concern. "Oh, if you only knew the actuarial charts as I know them. For $20,000, you must lose at least a finger, or preferably a larger appendage. If we are speaking of less visible matters, a vital organ or one of your five senses will do." But in fact, ever since I had awoken from the explosion, something had been nagging at me that I could not name, an itch that was not physical. Now I knew what it was. I had forgotten something, but what that something was, I did not know. Of the three types of forgetting, this was the worst. To know what one had forgotten was common, as was the case with dates of history, mathematical formulas, and people's names. To forget without knowing one has forgotten must be even more common, or maybe less, but it is merciful. In this case, one cannot realize what is lost. But to know that one has forgotten something without knowing what that something was made me shudder. "I have lost something," I said, pain getting the better of me and making itself audible in my voice. "I've lost a piece of my mind." Violet and the representative exchanged glances. "I'm afraid I don't understand," he said. "A portion of my memory," I said, "completely erased from the explosion until now." "Unfortunately, you may find that hard to prove." "How to prove to someone else that one has forgotten something, or that one has known something and no longer knows it?" "Nevertheless," I persisted with the representative. Even in my bedridden state, the old instincts remained, like rolling one's own cigarettes or rolling one's R's. Lying was a skill and a habit not easily forgotten. This was true also for the representative, whose kindred tricky spirit I recognized. In negotiations, as in interrogations, a lie was not only acceptable, but also expected. All sorts of situations exist where one tells lies in order to reach an acceptable truth, and our conversation continued thus until we agreed on the mutually acceptable sum of $10,000, which, of being only half what I asked for, was twice their original offer. After the representative wrote a new check, I signed the documents and we traded farewell pleasantries that were worth as little as the trading cards of unknown baseball players. At the door, Violet paused with her hand on the knob, looked over her shoulder at me. "Was there ever a more romantic pose, even with a woman such as her?" and said, "You know, we couldn't have done this movie without you." To believe her was to believe in a femme fatale, in an elected official, in little green men from outer space, in the benevolence of the police, in holy men like my father, who not only had holes in his socks, but also had a hole somewhere in his soul. But I wanted to believe, and what did it hurt to believe her little white lie? Nothing. I was left with the beat of a trashy discotheque in my head and a green check that proved I was somebody worth more dead than alive. All it cost me, unless they had lied, was a lump on my head and a portion of my memory, something of which I already had too much. Even so, why did I suspect that an operation had been performed on me while I was under the influence, leaving me with numbness more disturbing than pain? Why did I feel some phantom limb of memory, an absence on which I kept trying to rest my weight? Returning to California with these questions unanswered, I cashed my check and left half in my heretofore barren bank account. The day I visited the General and Madame, the other half was in an envelope in my pocket. Later that afternoon, I drove to Monterey Park, where, amid that city's suburbs, soft and bland as tofu, I had an appointment with the crapulent major's widow. I confessed that my plan was to give her the money in my pocket, money that I admit could have been used for more revolutionary purposes. But what is more revolutionary than helping one's enemies and his kin? What is more radical than forgiveness? Of course, he was not the one asking for forgiveness. I was, for what I had done to him. There was no sign of what I had done to him in the carport, nor did the apartment building's microclimate shimmer with the atmospheric disturbance of his ghost. Although I did not believe in God, I believed in ghosts. I knew this to be true because, while I did not fear God, I feared ghosts. God would never appear to me, whereas the crapulent major's ghost had, and when his door opened, I held my breath, fearing that it might be his hand on the doorknob. But it was only his widow who was there to greet me, a poor woman whom bereavement had thickened rather than starved. "Captain, it's so good to see you." She invited me to sit on her floral sofa, covered in transparent plastic that squeaked whenever I shifted my weight. Already waiting for me on the coffee table were a pot of Chinese tea and a plate of French ladyfingers. "Have a ladyfinger," she urged, pressing the treats on me. I knew the brand, the exact company that manufactured the Petit Écolier biscuits of my childhood. No one could make a guilty pleasure like the French. Ladyfingers had been my mother's favorite, given to her by my father as a lure, although she used the word gift when she mentioned it to me in my teenage years. I had enough consciousness to realize what a priest bearing ladyfingers to a child meant, for my mother was nothing but a child at 13 when my father came wooing. In some cultures today, or in the past, 13 was good enough for matches, marriage, and motherhood, or perhaps just 2 out of 3 on some occasions, but not in contemporary France or our homeland. Not that I did not understand my father, who at the time he fathered me was a few years older than I was now, with a ladyfinger melting in my mouth. A girl at 13, I had to admit having thoughts on occasion about particularly mature American girls, some of whom at 13 were more developed than college girls in our homeland. But these were thoughts, not deeds. We would all be in hell if convicted of our thoughts. "Have another ladyfinger," the crapulent major's widow urged, picking one up and leaning forward to thrust it in my face. She would have forced that sweet digit between my lips with maternal urgency, but I intercepted her hand, taking the ladyfinger for myself. "They're delicious, absolutely delicious," I said. "Let me just have a sip of tea first." At this, the good lady burst into tears. "What's the matter?" I said. "Those are the exact words he say," she said, which made me nervous, as if the crapulent major was even now manipulating me from behind the curtain separating the theater of life from the backstage of the afterlife. "I miss him so much," she cried. I squeaked my way across the plastic expanse between us and patted her on the shoulder as she wept. I could not help but see the crapulent major as I last encountered him in person, if not in spirit. On his back, with a third eye in his forehead, his other eyes open and blank. If God did not exist, then neither did divine punishment. But this meant nothing to ghosts who did not need God. I did not need to confess to a God I did not believe in, but I did need to appease the soul of a ghost whose face, even now, gazed at me from the altar on the side table. There, in full cadet uniform, was the young crapulent major, photographed at that phase before his first chin even dreamed of grandfathering a third chin, dark eyes staring at me as I comforted his widow. All he had to eat in the afterlife was a navel orange frosted with mold, a dusty can of Spam, and a roll of lifesavers. Arrayed in front of his photograph, and illuminated by the incongruous blinking Christmas lights he had hung on the altar's edge. Inequality ruled even in the afterlife, where the descendants of the rich feted them with heaping platters of fresh fruit, bottles of champagne, and cans of pâté. Genuinely devoted descendants burned paper offerings that included not only the usual cutouts of cars and homes, but also Playboy centerfolds. The hot body of a pliant woman was what a man wanted in the cold, long afterlife, and I swore to the crapulent major I would make him an offering of the fantastic, pneumatic Miss June. To his widow, I said, I promised your husband that if the need ever arose, I would do my utmost to take care of you and your children. Everything else I told her was the truth, my supposed accident in the Philippines and my reward, half of it in the envelope I pressed on her. She resisted gracefully, but when I said, think of the children, she gave in. There was nothing after that but to surrender to her demand that I see the children. They were in the bedroom, asleep, as all children should be. They're my joy, she whispered, as we gazed down on the twins. They're keeping me alive in these difficult days, Captain. Thinking about them, I don't think about myself so much, or my dear beloved husband. I said, they're beautiful, which may or may not have been a lie. They were not beautiful to me, but they were beautiful to her. I admit to not being an aficionado of children, having been one and having found my cohort and myself generally despicable. Unlike many, I was not intent on reproducing myself, deliberately or accidentally, since one of myself was more than enough for me to handle. But these children, just a year old, were still unconscious of their guilt. In their sleeping alien faces, I could see them as the naked and easily frightened new immigrants they were, so recently exiled into our world. The only advantage I had over these twins was that I had had a father in my childhood to teach me about guilt, and they would not. My father taught classes for the children of the diocese, which my mother forced me to attend. In his schoolroom I learned my Bible and the history of my divine father, the story of my Gaelic forefathers, and the catechism of the Catholic Church. At that time, when my years could be counted on the fingers of two hands, I was naive and ignorant of the fact that this father in his black cassock, this holy man who sweated in his unnatural garb to save us from our tropical sins, was also my father. When I did know, it recast everything I learned from him, beginning with this most basic tenet of our faith drilled into our young platoon of Catholics by the father as he walked before our class, reading our lips as we collectively droned the answer. Question. What is the sin called that we inherit from our first parents? Answer. The sin that we inherit from our first parents is called original sin. For me, the truly important question that had always preoccupied me was related to this original sin, for it concerned my father's identity. I was 11 when I learned the answer. My knowledge, triggered by an incident on the dusty grounds of the church after Sunday school, a territory where we children reenacted on one another many a biblical atrocity. As we watched the father's imported bulldog thrust away at a whining female companion in the shade of a eucalyptus tree, his tongue hanging, the pink balloon of his enormous scrotum swinging back and forth with hypnotic rhythm, one of my more knowledgeable classmates offered a supplement to this lesson in sex education. A dog and a bitch, that's natural, he said. But him... And here he turned scornful eyes and fingers on me. He's like what happens when a cat and a dog do that. Everyone's attention turned to me. I stood there as if on a boat, drifting away from the shore where they all waited, seeing myself through the eyes of others as a creature neither dog nor cat, neither human nor animal. A dog and a cat, this little comedian said to me, a dog and a cat. When I punched him in the nose, the comedian bled but was silent, shocked. His eyes momentarily crossed as he tried to see the damage. When I punched him again in the nose, the blood gushed, and this time the comedian cried out loudly. I punched him again, working my way from ears to cheeks to solar plexus and then to the hunched shoulders that he drew up around his head to protect himself when he fell to the ground and I fell on top of him. Our peers gathered around us, yelling, screaming, and laughing as I continued to pummel him until my knuckles stung. Not a single one of these witnesses offered to intervene on behalf of the comedian, who finally stopped me when his sobs began sounding like the strangled laughter of someone hearing the best joke ever told. When I stood up, the yelling, screaming, and laughing subsided, and in the adorable faces of those little monsters, I could see fear, if not respect. I walked home in confusion, wondering what exactly I had learned, unable to put it into words. My mind had no room for anything but the obscene picture of a dog mounting a cat, her animal face replaced by that of no one else but my mother, an image so upsetting that when I arrived home and saw her, I burst into tears and confessed everything that had transpired that afternoon. My child, you are not unnatural, my mother said, clutching me to her as I sobbed against the cushion of her bosom, musky with her distinct fragrance. You are God's gift to me. Nothing or no one could be more natural. Now listen to me, child. When I looked up into her eyes through the mist of my tears, I saw that she too was weeping. You have always wanted to know who your father is, and I told you that when you knew, you would be a man. You would have to say goodbye to your childhood. Are you sure you want to know? When a mother asks her boy if he is ready to be a man, can he say anything else but yes? So I nodded and held her tight, my chin on her breast and my cheek on her collarbone. You must not tell anyone what I am about to tell you. Your father is... She said his name. Seeing the confusion in my eyes, she said, I was very young when I was his maid. He was always very kind to me, and I was grateful. He taught me how to read and how to count in his language when my parents couldn't offer to send me to school. We spent a great deal of time together in the evenings, and he would tell me stories of France and his childhood. I could see he was very lonely. He was the only one of his kind in our village, and it seemed to me that I was the only one of my kind, too. I broke away from my mother's bosom, covering my ears. I no longer wanted to hear, but I was mute, and my mother continued talking. I no longer wanted to see, but images floated before me even though I closed my eyes. He taught me the word of God, she said, and I learned to read and count by studying the Bible and memorizing the Ten Commandments. We read sitting at each other's side at his table by lamplight. And one night... But you see, that is why you are not unnatural, child. God himself sent you, because God would never have permitted what happened between your father and me unless he had some role for you in his great plan. That is what I believe and what you must do. You have a destiny. Remember that Jesus washed the feet of Mary Magdalene and welcomed the lepers to his side, and stood against the Pharisees and the powerful. The meek shall inherit the earth, child, and you are one of the meek. If my mother saw me now, standing over the crapulent major's children, would she still think me one of the meek? And as for those sleeping children, how long would they stay unawake to the guilt they already bore, to the sins and crimes they were doomed to commit? Was it not possible that each of them, in his little heart, as they tussled next to each other for their mother's breast, had already yearned, however briefly, for the disappearance of the other? But the widow was not waiting for an answer to these questions as she stood next to me, peering down at her womb's wonders. She was waiting for me to sprinkle on them the holy water of meaningless compliments, a necessary baptism that I reluctantly gave, and that so delighted the widow she insisted on cooking me dinner. I needed little encouragement, given my steady diet of frozen foods, and it soon became clear why the crapulent major had grown ever fatter under her love. Her shaking beef was beyond compare, Her stir-fry morning glory evoked my mother's. Her winter melon soup soothed my guilty agitation. Even her white rice was fluffier than what I usually ate, the equivalent of goose down when I had slept for years on synthetic fiber. "Eat, eat, eat," she cried. And in that command it was impossible not to hear my mother's voice urging the same, no matter how meager our spread. So I ate until I could eat no more, and when I was done, she insisted there was still the unfinished plate of ladyfingers. Afterward, I drove to a nearby liquor store, an immigrant outpost operated by an impassive Sikh with an impressive handlebar mustache I could never hope to replicate. I bought a copy of Playboy, a carton of Marlboro cigarettes, and an achingly lovely see-through bottle of Stolichnaya vodka. That name, with its echoes of Lenin, Stalin, and Kalashnikov, made me feel better about my capitalist indulgences. Vodka was one of the three things the Soviet Union made that were suitable for export, not counting political exiles. The other two were weapons and novels. Weapons I professionally admired, but vodka and novels I loved. A 19th-century Russian novel and vodka accompanied each other perfectly. Reading a novel while one sipped vodka legitimized the drink, while the drink made the novel seem much shorter than it truly was. I would have returned to the store to buy such a novel, but instead of the Brothers Karamazov, it stocked Sergeant Rock comics. It was then, hesitating in the parking lot with my arms wrapped protectively around my paper bag of treasures, that I spotted a payphone. The urge to call Sofia Mori nagged me. I had been delaying it for some perverse reason, playing hard to get even though she had no idea I was here to be gotten. Rather than waste a dime and call her, I jumped into my car and drove across the great expanse of Los Angeles. I felt somewhat at peace after having made my blood payment to the crapulent major's widow, and as I sped down the freeway, sparse with traffic in the postprandial hours, I heard the crapulent major's ghost chortling in my ear. I parked my car down the crowded street from Miss Morey's apartment and took my paper bag of treasures with me, except for the Playboy, which I left in the rear seat for the crapulent major's ghost, open to the centerfold of Miss June, sprawled fetchingly on a stack of hay, with nothing on except cowgirl boots and a neckerchief. Miss Morey's neighborhood was as I remembered it, beige houses with fading toupees of lawn, and gray apartment buildings with the institutional charm of army barracks. The lights glowed in her apartment, the scarlet curtains pulled shut. When she opened the door, the first thing I noticed was her hair, grown down to her shoulders and no longer permed but straight, rendering her younger than I remembered, an effect compounded by her simple clothes, a black T-shirt and blue jeans. "It's you," she cried, opening her arms to me. When we embraced, it all came back. Her use of baby powder instead of perfume, her perfect body temperature, her small, plush breasts, usually encased in bras well padded enough to handle fragile objects, but tonight free of all such restraint. "Why didn't you call? Come in!" She pulled me inside the familiar, minimally decorated apartment, furnished in the spirit of revolutionary self-denial she admired in the likes of Che Guevara and Ho Chi Minh, men who traveled light. The largest piece of furniture she owned was a foldable futon in the living room in which her black cat usually sat. This cat had always kept her distance from me. This was not due to fear or respect, for whenever Miss Morey and I made love, the cat perched on the nightstand and evaluated my performance with disdainful green eyes, occasionally spreading a paw and licking between her bare claws. The cat was present, but she was not lounging directly on the futon. Instead, she lay on the lap of Sonny, who sat on the futon with legs crossed underneath himself, barefooted. He grinned apologetically, but nevertheless exuded an aura of ownership as he shooed the cat off his lap and rose. "It's good to see you again, old friend," he said, extending his hand. "Sophia and I often talk about you." Chapter 13. What did I expect? I had been missing for 7 months, and never once phoned, the extent of my communication a few scribbled postcards. As for Miss Morey, she was dedicated to neither monogamy nor man, much less to any one man in particular. She declared her allegiances through the most prominent furnishings in her living room, bookshelves, bowed as the backs of coolies with the weight of Simone de Beauvoir, Anais Nin, Angela Davis, and other women who had wrestled with the woman question. Western men from Adam to Freud had also asked that question, although they had phrased it as, "What does woman want?" At least they had considered the subject. It occurred to me only then that we Vietnamese men never even bothered to ask what woman wanted. I had not even a germ of an idea about what Miss Morey wanted. Perhaps I would have had a dim sense if I had read some of these books, but all I knew of them were the summaries found in their dust jackets. My intuition told me Sonny had actually read some of them in their entirety, and taking a seat next to him, I could feel an anaphylactic reaction to his presence prickling on my skin, an eruption of hostility inflamed by his genial smile. "What do you have there?" Sonny said, nodding at the paper bag on my lap.
Miss Morey had gone to fetch another wine glass. A pair already sat on the coffee table, along with an open bottle of red wine,
a corkscrew with the wine-bloodied cork still skewered on it, and a photo album. "Cigarettes," I said, taking out the carton, "and vodka." I had no choice but to offer Sonny the vodka, which he showed to Miss Morey when she returned from the kitchen. "You shouldn't have," she said brightly, putting it next to the bottle of wine. The beautiful, transparent Stolichnaya maintained a stoic Russian demeanor, as we regarded it in silence. Every full bottle of alcohol has a message in it, a surprise that one will not discover until one drinks it. I had planned to read that bottle's message with Miss Morey, as was obvious to her and Sonny, and we might have all simply sat there soaking in the frigid waters of embarrassment, if it had not been for Miss Morey's grace.
"It's very thoughtful of you," she said,
"especially as we've almost run out of cigarettes. I'll have one, if you don't mind." "So," Sonny said, "how was your trip to the Philippines?"
"I want to hear all about it," Miss Morey said, pouring me a glass of wine and refilling theirs. "I've always wanted to go ever since my uncle talked about his time there in the war." I cracked open the carton and offered her a cigarette, took one for myself, and began my well-rehearsed tale. The cat yawned in regal contempt, climbed back onto Sonny's lap, stretched out, sneered at me, then fell asleep from boredom. I had the distinct impression that Sonny and Miss Morey were only marginally more interested as they listened to me, smoked my cigarettes, and asked some polite questions. Dispirited, I did not even have the heart to tell them about my near-death experience, and my story tapered off without a climax. My gaze fell on the photo album, which was open to a page of black-and-white photos depicting middle-aged scenes from a few decades earlier. A father and a mother at home in their lace-covered armchairs, their sons and daughters playing the piano, crocheting, gathered around a dining table for a meal, wearing the fashion and hairstyle of the 30s. "Who are they?" I said.
"My family," said Miss Morey.
"Your family?" The answer stupefied me. Of course I knew that Miss Morey had a family, but she rarely talked about them and certainly had never shown me photographs of them. All I knew was that they lived far north of here, in one of the dusty, hot San Joaquin Valley towns. "That's Betsy and that's Eleanor," Sonny said, leaning over to point out the relevant faces. "Here's George and Abe. Poor Abe." I looked at Miss Morey, sipping her wine.
"He died in the war?"
"No," she said. "He refused to go to war, so he got sent to prison instead. He's still bitter about it. Not that he shouldn't be. God knows I'd probably be bitter if I were him. I'd just like for him to be happier than he is. The war is 30 years past, and it still lives with him, even though he didn't go and fight."
"He fought," Sonny said. "He just fought at home. Who can blame him? The government puts his family in a camp and then asks him to go fight for the country. I'd be mad as hell, too."
A mist of smoke now separated the three of us. The faint eddies of our thoughts took fleeting, evanescent material shape, and for a brief moment a ghostly version of myself hovered over Sonny's head.
"Where's Abe now?" I said.
"Japan. Not that he's any happier there than he was here. After the war ended and he was freed, he thought he'd go back to his people, the way that he'd been told to all his life by white people, even though he was born here. So he went and found out that the people in Japan didn't think he was one of them, either. To them, he's one of us, and to us, he's one of them. Neither one thing nor another."
"Maybe our department chair can help him," I said.
"God, I hope you're joking," said Miss Morey. Of course I was joking, but as an unwilling partner in this complicated ménage à trois, I was off my rhythm. I steadied myself by finishing my wine. When I looked at the wine bottle, I saw that it was empty. "Would you like some of the vodka?" Miss Morrie said. Her gaze was loaded with pity, which was ever only served lukewarm. Longing flooded the basement.